Calvin, the 20th talk in a series titled History of Christian Thought, was presented by David Crabtree on March 7, 1988, for McKinsey Study Center School of Exegesis. McKinsey Study Center is now an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
In 1531, Zwingli died in battle. He went out. Apparently, it was inter-city warfare.
That's right. It's right to the point.
And was killed in battle. That was in 1531. Then his place was taken by Bullinger, and I'll talk about him in a second. Zwingli's theology first. In my estimation, there are some differences, and it's the differences that I'm more interested in talking about. First of all, in the first, say, 7 centuries of the development of the church, I would say that these are the 3 most important. The only one that might be competitive here is Irenaeus, in the sense that they were trying to rediscover the golden ages of the past. So he was educated, basically he was a classicist, had a classical education. And that was his approach in studying scripture. His conclusions then were based upon a study caught on and became very widespread. Also the fact that he took the works. And the cornerstone of his theology was the sovereignty of God. That was very heavily stressed. God is in control of everything that happens, whether it's good or whether it's bad. He believed in double predestination, same as Augustine earlier, that those people are predestined to heaven as well as predestined to hell. He believed that God ordained the fall that occurred in the Garden of Eden, that even before the fall, man did not have free will in the sense that man could do whatever he wanted to do and God didn't have a role in it. God ordained even the fall. As a result, then, his soteriology, that is, his understanding of how man is saved, clearly ruled out works. Man is not saved by doing good deeds, but rather man is saved by faith, which is put into man by God, into the elect by God. His view of the gospel and the law, more of the law. Remember that Luther believed that the Old Testament law is no longer binding on us. Zwingli took the position that there are 3 parts to the Old Testament law. There is the moral law in the Old Testament law. That portion of the Old Testament law is binding on all men at all times. The moral law, for instance, would be do not commit murder. Thou shalt not kill. That would be part of the moral law. That's binding on all people at all times. The ceremonial law, that is, for instance, circumcision. Those were laws that were given for ceremonial purposes to the people of Israel. But they contain truths, spiritual truths, that are binding on all people at all times. So, for instance, where there was circumcision in the Old Testament, now it's infant baptism. Because of the work of Christ, those ceremonial laws have been replaced with practices that ought to be followed now. The sacrifices. Christ was the sacrifice, so sacrifices no longer need to be made. Yes, either it's been done away with by the work of Christ, or there is a replacement for it. Well, yes, not like later Reformed theologians. He did not believe that any of the sacraments were anything but signs to other believers. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so there's the moral law, there's the ceremonial law, and the third category is civil law. For instance, tithes would be an example. That, well, for him it was an example. What's an example?
Family responsibility for taking care of the widows in a certain order.
Some of those he would probably put in the moral law. The seven-year jubilee might be one of those. Doing away with all debts every 7 years. So he is the first one to establish these three categories for the Old Testament law. And these become a part of the Reformed tradition, and they exist. I mean, within the Reformed tradition, these are still maintained. Now, I was looking at our schedule for next quarter, and I'm not sure that we'll get to this, so I'll just briefly mention it right now. There is a movement right now called, it has several names. Theonomy is one name. The Reconstructionist is another name. The Chalcedon Movement, if you've heard of any of those.
Now or at this time?
No, that exists now in our time.
Today.
Traditionally, what the Reformed theologians would say is that the moral law is still binding on us. The ceremonial law has been transformed, but is still binding on us in its new form. Civil law is not binding on us. What the Reconstructionists are saying is there is no way that you can draw a line between that which is ceremonial law and that which is civil law, or between those moral law and civil law. You can't point to a law and say that's civil law as opposed to being ceremonial or moral. I mean, like the thing about the parapet around the roof. If someone said that that was civil, an equally good argument could be made, no, that's moral. So what the Theonomists say is you can't draw lines between these. Therefore, they are all binding on us. Well, I'm not sure that they would, I don't know if they would say that. I'm afraid to say that they would say that. But it doesn't matter. They're all binding. They would say they're all binding. The only thing is they would agree that the ceremonial law has been transformed. It is to be followed in a different way in our day and age. I don't know what they would say about that. My guess is that they would have a way of distinguishing three. That they would say there is a way to distinguish three, but I don't know for sure. But for instance, the statement that has got them into trouble is they are not opposed to the reintroduction of slavery because the Old Testament law makes provisions for slavery under certain circumstances and certain... Well, they aren't saying... I mean, they obviously won't be. Okay, so that's just kind of a sidelight, but this division of the Old Testament law since the time of Zwingli became a part of Reformed theology. Well, let me talk about the sacraments. He says there are two sacraments. There's the Lord's Supper and there's baptism, but neither of them are necessary. Neither of them are required for salvation. But it is just a matter of obedience to perform those acts. And that there is nothing mystical about them. There is no graces. They are not a means of grace. And they benefit the person partaking in no way. It is simply a sign to other people present, other believers present, that that person shares in the faith with the other people present. That person taking it shares the same faith with the others present. So it is merely a sign to others that person is a believer. And that's the most extreme position of any of those in the Reformed camp or the Lutheran camp. Because all the other Reformed theologians and all the Lutheran theologians believed that something else happened when someone participated in the sacraments. They believed that they were a means of grace. That's the phrase that Calvin uses. There is no spiritual benefit that comes from them whatsoever. Calvin is the one who, as far as I know, he's the first one to use this phrase, but then most of them adopt it. It's a means of grace, that it, in some way there is spiritual benefit that comes from participating in the sacrament. If I drink the wine and eat the bread, it's not just a sign, it is a sign to other believers, but also I receive some mystical benefit. They, most of them only recognize two sacraments. I ran across a definition earlier this week. Let me see if I can recall it. It is an activity or a commitment that receives special divine sanction. In the Roman Catholic Church, there are seven, is that right? There are seven sacraments: baptism, communion, marriage, holy orders, extreme unction, confession. There's one more, I can't remember. Okay, those are basically the differences. Luther stressed much more the sinfulness of man. That was Luther's starting point, and that's what he continued to stress. In Reformed theology, they believed that to be true, but they stressed more the sovereignty of God. And as a result, their teaching on the sovereignty of God stressed God's control of everything to a greater degree than Luther stressed that. The Reformed theologians basically generally believed that the Old Testament law is binding on us. Luther said that it was not. However, Luther, by predisposition, taught that we should retain everything from the Catholic tradition, which is not denounced by Scripture. The Reformed theologians took the perspective that you're free to do anything unless it is denounced. You throw out everything that's not mandated by Scripture.
And you said they did think the ceremonial law was binding?
Yes.
But it was just looked different.
But it takes on a different form after Christ.
It wouldn't be binding, it wouldn't be binding if Jesus hadn't somehow worked it over.
The ceremonial law?
Yeah.
Before Christ, it was binding.
Yeah. But they're saying what Christ gave is not binding, but Christ did some.
Well, it's been transformed as a result of Christ. Yeah. Well, it depends which ceremony. If it was circumcision, it was transformed into infant baptism. If it was the sacrificial system, it was done away with. Some Reformed theologians would say that the Eucharist took its place. Well, the priesthood, the church, became an heir of Israel. So covenant theologians are oftentimes Reformed theologians. Zwingli didn't, but the other Reformed theologians thought that the sacraments were means of grace. Zwingli didn't believe that. Okay, there are two other Reformed theologians that lived at the same time as Zwingli, who for the most part shared his perspectives, and together they forged Reformed theology before Calvin, and then Calvin's the one who really put it together. I think it's Ocolan Pagius. I'm not sure how to pronounce this. Is it what they did? Another humanist. The humanists, they adopted Latin names. So, for instance, Jean Calvin became John Calvin. I don't know what his name was, but he adopted the Latin name of Olympadius. He studied Greek and Hebrew in Italy and Germany, and was an admirer of Erasmus. And he was probably the most well-educated of the early reformers.
And with classical education.
He was influenced by Luther. He heard Luther's views and was, for the most part, persuaded by them. Continued to study and initiated reform in Basel, Switzerland. So we've got Zurich and Basel are the two hot spots early on. And he ended up participating in quite a number of debates in southern Germany and northern Switzerland in favor of his particular theological bent. 1482 to 1531. He didn't live more than a year after Zwingli. He died in 1831, soon after Zwingli did. The next person is Bullinger, and he's the first one that will overlap with Calvin. Zwingli and Ocolan Pagius didn't live didn't live long enough to be around when Calvin was active. Bullinger also was studied at a classical education at Cologne in Germany. He became convinced during his course of studies that the scripture was that which is authoritative in Christianity, and devoted his time to studying the scripture. And in studying it, became aware of Luther's views and was convinced that Luther had a far better understanding of scripture than the scholastics did. And he read Melanchthon's work, and I don't know how to pronounce it, Loci, Comes, whatever. But it was Melanchthon was Luther's right-hand man. Melanchthon outlived Luther, and Melanchthon was Luther's right-hand man, and his beliefs coincided with Luther's to the best of anyone's ability to determine. After Luther died, well, even when Luther was alive, Melanchthon began to put some structure to Luther's theology, systematize it. And some of his works were written while Luther was alive, and Luther said, yeah, that's what I believe. Yeah, that's right. He continued to write such things after Luther died. Luther didn't have much to say about those things. But some other people have had things to say about those. Theologians at the time and later have accused Melanchthon of changing Luther's theology, of amending it. But I find it hard to believe that he changed it significantly. But one of his works was, and I think this means points in common with things that they agreed on, that the Lutheran theologians agreed on. Bullinger, so it's basically just a treatise on Lutheran theology. Bullinger agreed with that. He thought, he was convinced that that was accurate. He went to work as a priest teaching in a monastery and convinced the monks that monasticism was not biblical, and they disbanded the monastery, so he lost his job. Went to Zurich and taught under Zwingli for a while, and then when Zwingli died, he took over and was the pastor, the head of the church in Zurich until his death in 1575. He had a large following in Zurich. Most of these early reformers are remarkable for their integrity. I mean, every one of them, they go into a teaching situation, and even if it's financially detrimental to say what they believe to be true, they do it anyway. And even if they're going to lose their job if they say what they believe to be true, they do it anyway. An incredible amount of integrity, as well as a genuine concern for the people that they are working with. Zwingli was noted in Zurich for taking care of people who had come down with the plague, and he contracted it himself and almost died. Bullinger did the same thing. Later the plague came through again, and Bullinger did the same thing. Also, when Zwingli died in battle, Bullinger took care of his widow and Zwingli's children until the children were married off, and until Zwingli's widow died. So most of these reformers were remarkable for their integrity as well as their concern for the people that they were around. Okay, Calvin. Now, Calvin's the one who really pulls Reformed theology together. Even though Locolampadius and Bullinger were heavily influenced by Luther early on, their views come to coincide more with Zwingli's as time goes on than with Luther's. So they are truly part of the Reformed tradition. But the one who really puts it together is John Calvin. Calvin was a Frenchman. He was born in 1509. He received a very good education, studied in Paris. At the age of 14, was apparently quite precocious, did extremely well. At that time, the University of Paris was reactionary. The views of Luther, by the time he was in school, the views of Luther were getting around, as well as one of the teachers of Paris, Lefebvre. Let me back up a minute. He's in Paris. There is a professor there by the name of Lefebvre who wrote a work, a commentary on the Psalms in... Oh, he wrote it in 1509. He wrote a commentary on the Psalms in 1509. When Luther was studying the Psalms to teach, he read Lefebvre's work, and that influenced his interpretation of the Psalms. When Calvin goes to college, university in Paris, at that time Lefebvre is still a professor there and is still espousing his same views. Furthermore, some of Luther's views are beginning to hit Paris, as well as most of Northern Europe. Paris turns reactionary, very defensive of the papal position. And we don't really know what Calvin's reaction is to that, except that, and he doesn't appear to be very religiously minded at this time, but that's the atmosphere when he was there. And he did have, apparently, a good relationship with Lefebvre. At the age of 18, he received his master's degree from Paris, and his father talked him into studying law at Bruges in Belgium, which he went and did. But while studying law, he studied Greek and Hebrew, and ended up receiving his doctorate in law. Then he went through a period of wandering when he didn't seem to know what he wanted to do. And he spent some time with a man who was a Waldensian. His name was Etienne de la Forge, and studied at him. Okay, he's wandering around. He goes and stays with a man by the name of Etienne de la Forge, who is a Waldensian, and apparently is introduced to some Waldensian ideas while he is there. At about this time, he also begins writing. He wrote a couple of works. I can't remember what the first one was, but the second one was a commentary on some writings by a Latin writer, Lucius Annaeus Seneca, and Gonzalez, no, McNeil, a guy who wrote a biography on Calvin, makes this comment. He says, "The work is of interest as Calvin's first commentary. The others would be on scripture books, but would follow a method closely similar. The method was not new. Calvin sets down a short passage from the treatise and subjects it to critical examination. He writes informally, studying the words employed, often referring to their use in other contexts, supplying historical details, explaining philosophical concepts, and indicating his own judgment of the author's views." So he ends up, his commentary that he writes on Seneca's works uses the same process, the same technique that he had learned in his classical education, and it's the same one that he applies to scripture later on. And he becomes, I think, one of the best interpreters of scripture that has ever lived. He's very perceptive, very coherent, very true to the text. As during his wandering period, he begins to write things and say things that in defense of various Protestants that were beginning to arise in France. And as a result of and he met with Lefebvre at this time, and McNeil speculates that Lefebvre convinced him that moderation, a course of moderation, was not possible. One could not take the course of someone like Erasmus and hope that it would be that the Catholic Church could be reformed from within. And it's soon after that that Calvin writes more caustic writings in defense of various Protestants and is charged with heresy. Having been charged with heresy, he has to leave France, which he does, and he goes and travels in Germany and Switzerland. During his travelings, he goes through Geneva and meets a man by the name of Farrell, William Farrell, who convinces him to stay in Geneva and teach there, which he reluctantly decides to do. Geneva at that time is the Las Vegas of Europe. It's the red light district just outside of France, and known for corruption,
for loose women and for gambling. And that's where Farrell convinces Calvin to stay and become a teacher in the church, which he does. And as you can probably imagine, the economic forces are against the kind of teaching that Calvin would be apt to give. And so it isn't too long before Calvin and Farrell are driven out of Geneva by the economic forces that don't like his perspective on morality. He goes to Strasbourg, and there's a large community of Frenchmen who have been kicked out of France because of their religious views, Protestants. And there he enters into dialogue with Melanchthon and another Lutheran theologian, Bucer. Strasbourg is another city that's just across the border from France. In his dialogues with Melanchthon and Bucer, it was hoped that Reformed theology and Lutheran theology could be brought to an accord. But it was unsuccessful again, and apparently the historians think that Melanchthon and Bucer were hoping that they could still, that the Lutheran movement could still be reunited with Catholicism. And so they were reluctant to appear to compromise on certain points, such as the sacraments. While in Strasbourg, Calvin got married to a French woman that he met there. And then, after he'd been in Strasbourg a few years, which he considered to be the happiest years of his life, there was an opportunity to return to Geneva, and reluctantly he agreed to do so. He went back to Geneva, and this time he and others were able to turn the city completely around. By this time there had been quite a few more Frenchmen, Protestants, who had gone to Geneva, and so there was more of a political power base from which to operate. So Calvin was not driven out again. And slowly, Calvin's ideas became the law. He was not a part of the civil government, and he chose to stay out of civil government. Geneva was run by people other than Calvin. However, Calvin was a strong force in the community, and to a large degree, rule was conducted along the lines that were prescribed by Calvin. In Geneva, during the time that Calvin's views were in control, a number of Englishmen who had been kicked out of England came and lived there for a period of time, including John Knox. And the reason that that's important is because those Englishmen end up taking those views back to England. And that's what creates the Reformation in England. That's where we get the Westminster Confession, which sounds so Calvinistic. And Calvin died in 1564. His greatest, his most significant work was what's called the Institutes of the Christian Religion. They're usually called Calvin's Institutes. It started out fairly short, and it was just a description of Reformed theology, and which was a letter to the King of France. It was a letter to the King of France that described Reformed theology, saying, "This is all we want. This is all we believe. We aren't interested in destroying your country. There's no reason you should come out and kill us." And he revised it several times, and so it kept growing, and finally reached its maximum size, which is a fairly comprehensive description of Calvinistic theology. The one I have is two volumes, but I don't know.
Is that the whole thing?
Yeah.
Well, they're usually referred to as Calvin's Institutes, but I think the title is the Institutes of the Christian Religion. Well, I'm just debating whether to or not.
There was a man, Michael Servetus. There was a man, a theologian, who believed, he was a Unitarian. He believed that there is only God. There is not the Trinity, there is God. And that, I forget what his Christology was, but it approaches Arianism, that Christ was a man that was adopted by God. But I don't think it's quite that, but it approaches that. And Calvin had written a number of times refuting this guy's views, Servetus, I think his name is. And I think that he was living in Italy. He was kicked out of Italy for his heretical views and was traveling around from kind of being chased from one place to another. Well, by the Catholic Church initially. But he ended up by mistake in Geneva. And he was arrested in Geneva. And he was put to death for heresy.
By the government, basically, submitted to Calvin?
Yes. He was put together by the civil authorities in Geneva for heresy. And I can't recall what Calvin's role in it was. I think that he reluctantly agreed that this person should be put to death. I think that's true. McNeil has a section on that in his book, and I'll try to remember to read that and tell you next time. Well, obviously Calvin doesn't see them at all to be the same, because here is someone who is a heretic. Calvin accepted the Trinitarian formulations of the early councils, as did virtually all of the reformers. He believed that that was the truth. What they determined was the truth. And both the Catholic Church and the Protestants agreed on that. So when a person comes along, like whatever this guy's name is, Servetus or whatever his name is, that was something that everybody agreed was heretical. And so it wasn't that, I mean, here was a bona fide card-carrying heretic, as far as Calvin is concerned. That incident is the one that is pointed to in Calvin's career as the epitome of what Calvin stood for. And now, if you hear someone use the term Calvinism out on the street, that's what they have in mind. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Or what, often predestination.
Well, predestination as well as a theocracy. A theocracy that allows no room for theological deviation from the norm. But there are a couple of things to keep in mind. One is, that was the spirit of the times. The Catholics and the Protestants all believed that heretics ought to be killed. And they did it. They killed them. And it gets worse. As the positions harden in the Counter-Reformation, not only gross violations, both people who are clearly heretics were put to death, but others as well. So one thing to keep in mind is that it was the spirit of the times. And we're all influenced by the spirit of our times. We cannot see past blind spots that are thrown up by the culture around us. And the other thing is, I think his role is exaggerated in most accounts. As I recall, on second thought, with Servetus, Calvin agreed that he was a heretic and deserving of punishment by death, but I think he asked for a pardon and to allow him to leave and go to Poland, which is apparently where he was headed. But I will check on that and make sure. But in any case, Calvin was not a civil authority. And in fact, he took steps to make sure that there was separation between him and the civil authorities. And there were times when they would ask him what he thought they should do in certain circumstances, and he'd say, "I don't know, you decide." My guess is that he would if he thought it was a moral issue. My guess is that he would give his opinion, but I don't know.
Why wasn't he put to death?
Well, I think he just left. It's not anyone who's proclaimed heretic by the Catholic Church as a heretic.
But has to be a heretic.
But everyone who is.
Who Calvin thinks is a heretic.
Yeah. Not really. It's whoever whoever...
what standard?
Well, there are certain truths which it was commonly believed any Christian should accept, that it's clear. One is the Trinity, the view of the Trinity that came down from the early councils. And that every Christian should believe. And so someone who deviated from that is a heretic. That would be accepted by any of the early reformers except the Anabaptists later and the Unitarians. But virtually all of Christendom would have acknowledged that view of the Trinity as being. All of the early reformers accepted the first three or the first seven. They draw the lines differently.
Well, I'm going to skip. I'm not going to talk about Calvin theology because there isn't time. But there's one thing that I want to get to, and that's Arminius. Another one. In the Netherlands, there was a man by the name of Jacobus Arminius. He lived from 1560 to 1609. And Calvinism, or Reformed theology, was predominant in the Netherlands at this time. Arminius taught at a university in the Netherlands, believed himself to be a follower of Calvin, but there were a few views of his that differed from those of Calvin. And they were with regards to predestination. He believed that predestination was based on foreknowledge, and that Christ died for all men, not just for the elect. He died for all men so that all men could be saved. And man has free will to decide whether he will accept Christ by faith or not. He denied irresistible grace, which was a teaching of Calvin's, and he denied the perseverance of the saints. Once saved, always saved. And he denied that perseverance of the saints. And he won over quite a number of theologians to his perspective.
Man has free will to choose.
So there was quite a debate between the theologians in the Netherlands, and there was a Synod of Dort in 1618, which was called to decide whether Arminius' perspectives were scriptural or not.
Arminius.
And the Synod of Dort ends up reaffirming Calvin's views. And it's from that synod that we get the acronym TULIP. From the Netherlands, it makes sense. Actually, it wasn't. The acronym doesn't come from the Netherlands, but the 5 points of Calvinism were reaffirmed, were clearly stated at Dort. So here they become more clear than anyplace else. Now, if I can remember what they are. Total depravity. Limited atonement. Irresistible grace. No, not. That's not. Perseverance of the saints. Yeah, it must be. Irresistible grace. Total depravity. What's you? I think it's unmerited.
Unmerited grace.
I think it's unmerited grace. The thing that is very interesting to me about this little episode is, does it remind you of anything else that has happened? That someone comes to what?
After Augustine.
Exactly. It's exactly what happened after Augustine. Augustine came along and said that God predestined believers. And he even taught double predestination. He predestines to heaven and he predestines to hell. A stress on God's control of the whole process of salvation. And within a generation, you have coming along people who claim to be disciples of Augustine who
can't accept that. That cannot be true. And so what they say is that predestination is based on foreknowledge. And those were the semi-Pelagians. We have exactly the same thing happening with Calvinism. That within a generation after Calvin, we have someone coming along and saying, no, that part cannot be true. That kind of stress on divine sovereignty cannot be true.
So,
well, I'm going 40 years. People usually say generation 40 years. But the amount of change that takes place within a generation in the views of these theologians, there's one Calvinist theologian whose son completely renounces most of the distinctives of Calvinist theology. And now we still have Arminianism, which is a theology which stresses man's free will, and that predestination means foreknowledge. That God's predestination is based on foreknowledge. Stop there.